Capricorn, connect. People, potential, technology.
He is a serial entrepreneur, board member, strategist, innovator, speaker, and founder and CEO of Pipra. With Pipra, John Klepper developed a groundbreaking AI-based technology which prevents the outbreak of the disease delirium. Today we'll talk about what this disease is, delirium, and how to prevent it, but also what motivated John in developing this groundbreaking technology. John, thank you so much for being here in the podcast, now also in the as a video podcast. How are you today?
Thanks, Jacob. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm doing great. Love what you've set up here too. It's really, really spectacular.
John, tell us and the audience about Pipra. What is the background of the company and what motivated you setting this technology up?
With pleasure. So I've always been very motivated by impact, wanting to try to do good and give back. I was working in Alzheimer's disease, early detection and prevention, and for the same reasons. And then I came across this disease area called delirium, which I discovered is massively underserved and underrepresented, has awful consequences for the patients, for relatives, and also is a massive cost to hospitals. So I got super excited about trying to solve this problem. And then put an amazing team together to help us do that.
You also had a personal motivation behind it.
Right? Yeah, so there was a combination of this massive opportunity from a business perspective, from a emotional perspective, you know, to be able to do good. But as I learned more about delirium, and I'm happy to talk a little bit more about what that is, I called my mother up and I asked her if she could tell me in a bit more detail what had happened to her in hospital some years back. And she described this terrifying experience where she woke up after surgery and she was in her room and she thought that, you know, there were monsters coming out of the walls. She thought the staff were trying to kill her. She was for several days, she was terrified. And most patients that have delirium will describe it as the most terrifying experience of their life.
So it's like a hallucination.
Hallucination, memory loss, confusion, disorientation. It's for many patients, they recover within some days or weeks. My mother luckily had a full recovery. But many patients don't, and they end up, instead of going back home after the hospital, they go to a nursing home, they have dementia, or they die within a month. And what is very sad is that this disease is very preventable. And there's just not enough awareness about it within hospital. There's not enough awareness about it, this disease, in the general public. There's not enough people asking questions about, you know, is this going to happen? So what very often happens is people will say, especially when I do public speaking and talks, when I'll always have a few people afterwards come up to me after this talk and say, thank you so much for sharing your story. You know, this happened to my mother or to my father, my grandfather, you know, like they went to the hospital, they were super sharp. They had a hip surgery or knee surgery or whatever it is, you know, and they were never the same afterwards. And what they're describing is delirium. So we're together with my team. We've been able to develop AI-based algorithms to help predict which patients are at risk and then to help support the prevention of delirium within hospital.
And how much, if we talk numbers, how much do you think you can prevent with Pipra? The outbreak of delirium, like if you percentage wise, do you have any estimates?
Yeah, no, not estimates. We actually have proof now. We did one of the hospitals we work with here in Switzerland, one of the major hospitals, private hospital. They did a publication on the use of Pipra in their hospital, showing a 29% reduction of incidence in their hospital. And then since then, we've implemented in several other hospitals. including in Spain and Germany, in one of the major hospitals in Madrid in Spain, Getafe Hospital, we show a 43% reduction in incidence. Wow. And in Munich and LMU, we show a 72% reduction of delirium.
Wow, impressive.
Within their hospital. So we have now proven that we can not only predict which patients are at risk, but we can actually reduce this incidence massively, which is, of course, amazing for the patients, for the relatives, but also massively cost effective. Saves millions for the hospital, because delirium is actually one of the most expensive problems in healthcare. And I can give you some figures around that. It's 60% more expensive to healthcare than diabetes.
Wow. So you also would help the system with this technology. So it's not just like the patients, but also the system itself.
Yeah. So what happens when a patient has delirium? They end up staying much longer in hospital. They end up needing much more care while they're in hospital. It's often extremely stressful for the staff. And because they're staying much longer in hospital and have all these complications, it often leads to other complications, like an increase in falls, infections, pressure ulcers, readmission rates go up massively. So all of these come at a cost.
So it's like a chain reaction.
Exactly. Oh. Mm-hmm. So by reducing delirium, which is by far the most prevalent in hospital acquired complication, and again, I'll give you some numbers on that, it's 23% of patients over the age of 60. So nearly one in four patients over 60 going to the hospital will have delirium. Mm-hmm. So you reduce your delirium, you're also reducing all these other complications, which hospitals are spending millions trying to avoid. Infections. They go out of their way and spend a lot of time and effort and money to try to reduce infections or falls. So,
This is not a pharma product. It's not a medication. It's an AI-based technology. Can you elaborate a little bit about how you use AI for this product so I get a better picture?
Yeah, sure. So it is non-pharmacological in its approach. There is no magic pill today. So there is no treatment. If you get delirium, you basically, most you can do is sedate the patient, and that's often worse for the patient, but makes it a bit easier for the staff. So what we do is we know the risk factors for delirium. And there are many. It's very multifaceted, much like, mm-hmm. like dementia is very multifaceted. For one person, it might be something to do with their diet or their lack of sleep. For another person, it might be polymedication. There's all different kinds of things. Age is obviously a big risk factor. And so when a patient is admitted to the hospital, there's a lot of information that's entered into the electronic health record about the patient history. What is their age? What is their height and weight, BMI? What's their ASA score, ESA score? Like, how frail are they? What's the risk of the surgery, for example? Is it a small surgery or is it a larger, more invasive surgery? All this information gets entered into the EHR, and our system grabs the relative and necessary information, the risk factors that are relevant, and then calculates the risk in real time, stratifies that risk into risk groups from highest risk to lowest risk, right? And then communicates that to all the people in the hospital, the clinicians that need to know this high-risk patient. And then we monitor and see, make sure that patient gets the right treatment, make sure that the compliance is high on prevention, which is non-pharmacological, and make sure that they're getting the care that they need. So we're managing the care pathway, and we're making recommendations for what to do to ensure that patient doesn't get delirium. Mm-hmm. And on top, which is really important, actually, especially in prevention, it's really important to show outcomes. What is the reduction in incidence? What is the reduction in length of stay? What is the reduction in nursing hours? Why? Because unlike most medicine, which is reactive, you see a patient is bleeding, you stop the bleeding, you know that the work you did had a result, right? in the case of prevention, the patient is fine, and then you do this prevention work, and they're still fine, right? They didn't get delirium. But how do you know that what you did wasn't just wasting time, right? So to do effort to put out work preventively rather than reactively, you need to show the outcomes. You need to show that, that what they're doing is actually having an effect. And most healthcare professionals, they will be willing to do a little bit of extra work if they know that what they're doing is actually having a result, right?
Absolutely.
And in the balance, actually, because we're reducing the incidence so much, we're actually saving them a lot of time because patients need much less care. Delirium patients need a lot of care. So that's...
So AI, a huge help here in this context. So AI helps saving lives, essentially. Yeah?
100%. Mm. 100%.
John, I also have some questions. I'm quite interested in your background. You have a very interesting background. I mean, you used to work in the film industry. What brought you from the film industry into the health care sector? Maybe you can tell our viewers also a little bit about that.
Sure. That definitely wasn't planned. I think you know, we've talked about this before. As an entrepreneur, you know, your mindset is you're always looking at opportunities to change something, to make a difference, to innovate. You're always looking at life through a lens of how could this be better, or why isn't somebody doing this thing? And with that lens, So I started off in art. I was a trained artist, traditionally trained, painting, sculpture, whatnot. And then I went into photography, and then I got excited about film. And while I was doing my master's at the American Film Institute in Los Angeles, one of my teachers said, "Hey, I'm starting up a production company in visual effects. Do you want to help me get it off the ground?" And I was like, "That sounds great." As soon as I finished my master's, and he's like, "No, we're going now." So I had to kind of figure out how to do both. So it was a lot of nights and weekends. And then we built this production company, which grew very quickly. And we ended up working on some pretty exciting, you know, big feature films like the Matrix movies. And I got to taste what it feels like to be an entrepreneur. And then from there, I moved back to Europe and I started a similar animation visual effects company in Sweden. Brought an international team from all over the world to work on some pretty exciting things. And then built that company up to, at one point we had about 70 people in three countries, and then exited from there and started a software company that was a social enterprise, which basically supports about 40 different nonprofit and charity organizations around the world through this gamified giving, which is still running. So I was able to do a lot of good in the world, which I'm very proud of and my team's very proud of. And then I had a coffee with a neuroscientist. And we got into it, and I'm fascinated by brain health and always have been. So I started challenging him on some of the ideas he had for a business. And throwing some ideas out, and a few hours into this conversation, he asked me if I wanted to start a company with him. And I love challenges. So, I mean, at first I asked him, I said, "Look, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. Why would you want to work with me?" And he said, "Well, I've got that part covered. I need a business guy who understands how to run a company." And then it started to click that no matter what field you're in, running a business is fairly similar. Like there's, you know, you need to put a brilliant team together You need to make sure they're all motivated and working and running in the same direction. You need to make sure that they're all paid. You need to make sure that you're balancing finances, that you're, you know, that you have a strong strategy and you have a sales team and you have, you know, all the different things that you need to run a company. It's all basically the same thing, right? You need to manage the board. You need to report. You need to have good governance. All these things are pretty much all the same. So it's exciting because I get to learn new things all the time in each industry, and I get to work with brilliant people. And we do have an incredible team at BPRO. There's some fantastic PhDs and, you know, doctors and scientists and AI experts. Mm-hmm. And it's really cool.
And with all your experiences in scaling companies, setting up company structures, organizations, what do you think are sort of the challenges that you always have when a company starts to grow?
So, you know, finding the right team is, I think, one of the biggest challenges. And so important. It's so much more important to hire somebody that you know is going to work well in your team culturally and has the passion and the motivation, really has the drive, especially at a startup, because there's so many ups and downs, and there's so many times where you need to pull together and you need to support each other and you need to go through difficult times. And if the people don't have that drive and that commitment and that passion, and they don't have that culture, that feeling of team, they're just going to leave when it gets a bit difficult, mm-hmm. right? So that's, I think, one of the biggest challenges. And I think what that looks like in reality is, you know, you see an amazing CV and you think, oh, this would be perfect. We need this person so desperately. Mm-hmm. But you have this feeling that culturally, they might be complicated. It might be difficult. It might not fit in quite white, right? Do not hire that person. Mm-hmm. Like, trust your gut.
So culture is important.
Culture. Oh,
yeah. And the gut feeling.
The gut feeling, yeah. Like, you know, it's a relationship, mm-hmm. just like a normal relationship outside. You know, it's you're working with this person all the time, and they're working with mm-hmm. the team. And everybody needs mm-hmm. to have that, you know. I mean, of course, you fight. You have, it's very healthy, but at the end of the day, you need to get along. You need to have that drive and that passion. Mm-hmm. So,
would you rule somebody out who has like sort of the perfect CV and comes from big corporate, or is really
100%? Yeah, and I've made that mistake before. Mm-hmm. You know, a couple times hiring the perfect CV because I really needed that position filled. Mm-hmm. You know, and it had been 3, 4, 5 months I hadn't found somebody. You know, mm-hmm. and here comes this perfect CV. Had a bad feeling. Or not a bad feeling, but something mm-hmm. didn't feel quite right, you know? Big mistake. Mm-hmm. In one case, it almost cost me the company.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's so important. But then, you know, other challenges. Raising capital is a really huge, huge challenge. It's unbelievably time consuming. It's, you know, to do it well, it's a full-time job. You know, if you're lucky, you can get it done in a short window, you know, maybe 3, 4 months, 5 months. But especially in today's climate, investors are much more risk averse, and they're much more cautious. Their expectations for what they want to see at pre-seed, at seed, at series mm-hmm. A, you know, is much higher mm-hmm. than it used to be. So timelines stretch, and you need to be able to manage your business, run the business while also raising capital. And you have to have a lot of grit because it's a lot of no's and it's a lot of patience. Mm-hmm. And it's scary during that time because one of your number one responsibilities as a founder or CEO is to make sure the company has cash, mm-hmm. you know? And if you're a company that, especially in deep tech, where you have a long road, especially B2B, where you have a long road before you're mm-hmm. break even or profitable, raising capital is, you know, you live or die. Right? Yeah. So it's a tremendous amount of pressure. And One of the things that I really, really appreciate is spending time with fellow founders, entrepreneurs, and just being authentic and being honest about how difficult it is and sometimes how lonely it is. Mm-hmm. And just being able to share that with other people is, it's so important.
I think it also gets a bit glorified sometimes, maybe, like the whole entrepreneurship thing.
So, yeah, maybe. So. I mean, it definitely has its pluses. You know, there's, we wouldn't do it if it wasn't for, you know,
if it works, it's pretty good.
You know, it's, there's a lot of fabulous, you know, moments where you jump up and down and you hug each other and you celebrate, you know, with your team and with your fellow founders. But for every one of those moments, there's 10 like, oh my God, what are we going to do? And you just feel the weight on your shoulders get heavier and heavier and heavier.
The highs are pretty great and the lows are pretty low.
And so, you know, I'm very fortunate at Peepra that I have two amazing founders who are, you know, super supportive and I hope I'm the same, you know, for them. But we also, you know, we support each other also in our private lives. You know, if one of us is going through something, we're there for the other and make sure that they take time, you know, with their family, with their friends, whatever is needed. But it's, it's a journey. And it is not for the thin skinned or the thin hearted, lighthearted.
So you need a thick skin, definitely.
Yes.
John, what is the plan for the future for Peepra?
I mean, so our vision is, for now, is a world without delirium. And it may sound niche, right? Because delirium, I haven't heard of delirium. But as I said, it's 60% more expensive to healthcare in the United States than diabetes. And diabetes is a huge problem in the States. So that gives you an idea of the cost. I think it's estimated a couple years ago at $156 billion a year to U.S. healthcare, where diabetes is around $90 billion. It also affects that we know about 60 million people per year and growing.
Globally.
It's probably a bigger number than that because there's 70% of cases are missed. They're not diagnosed. So it is by itself a huge problem, and we could continue to focus just in delirium, but at a certain point, we want to expand beyond that into other types of complications, cognitively or not. So I think dementia is a very interesting area that we want to explore. It's also very closely linked to delirium, and I can tell you how. So if a patient has delirium in hospital, their risk of having dementia goes up 1,400%.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. So in many ways, it's like pre-dementia, right?
Wow.
And so you go in for, you know, like a knee surgery, for example. You're 70 years old, and you think, you know, my knee hurts a little bit, and I can't do the sports that I used to, and you know, I can still walk, and I can still do some things, you know, and I can, you know. My life is not that bad, but I can't do tennis anymore, whatever. You know, I can't play tennis anymore. So you think, oh, I'll just go have that surgery. It'll be fine, right? Would people be willing to take that risk if they knew they were at a reasonably high risk of having dementia, of losing their memory, of ending up in a nursing home or dying? No. Would they cancel the surgery? Not necessarily. Most of the time, they wouldn't, right? But you could have a conversation with your doctor, and you could say, could we do something minimally invasive and see how that goes, right? Or, you know, I actually have a very high risk, and I think I'll live with the knee the way it is, right? Now, there are, of course, other emergency situations. There are life-threatening operations you have to have. And in that case, if the hospital is using Peepra, then even if they're at high risk, their chances of getting delirium are massively reduced because they're getting the right care. They're getting the right attention. So it's not that we're saying, you know, you're going to cancel surgeries, but you're going to get the right attention to make sure you don't get this.
Okay, so a huge impact. John, finally, I have still some personal question, if it's okay with you. Also, a question I love to ask my guest is, if you had a choice, you can walk out of the studio today with a new superpower, which one would you pick next to your other superpowers that you already have?
That's a great question. I love that question. Empathetic resonance, I would say, would be maybe one of them.
Okay. Please explain.
Yeah. So like the ability to feel and understand the emotions of others. Mm-hmm. I think that's super important, especially today. There's so much disconnect, right? People are can't just have a conversation anymore. And so I think that would be a superpower, because what we say and what we feel are often very different, right? And if you extend that to how that would affect your relationship, you know, your family, you know, at home, with your family, how it would affect, you know, your coworkers, your team, your friends, you know, if you really knew what people were feeling, I think that's maybe one of them. And I don't know, maybe temporal insight, another one, right? So not being able to change the future, but to be able to at least from time to time occasionally see into the future and understand if the decisions you make now, what are the implications of that decision in the future?
Yeah, I would love to have that too.
Right?
Yeah, that's a good one, or two good ones. Yeah. And then which autobiography would you buy if you would pick one?
So many good ones. I haven't read Trevor Noah's Born a Crime.
You wrote one?
Yeah.
Okay. He's the comedian, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, also a podcaster.
Yeah, yeah.
but he had The Daily Show for, I think it was The Daily Show for many years. And he's
South African.
Not
right?
a podcaster, but an interviewer. He did a lot of interviews. Yeah. South African and Swiss, half Swiss, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Fantastic guy. Mm-hmm. And got to meet him very briefly in Doha, Qatar, actually, because he was there at Web Summit, and I was also doing a talk there. So I think that would be a fun one to read, because I think he's brilliant. He's had the chance to talk to presidents from around the world and so many amazing, influential people. But he's also a comedian, so I've heard that it's quite funny. You know, he brings a lot of humor into it too, which you have to bring humor into life as often as you can, I think. So that would be a good one, I think.
And final question, John, how will AI improve your life in 2 years?
How will it improve my life? Because we could go the other way with that conversation too. I think, and I'm hopeful that healthcare is going to be, going to continue to be an area of massive disruption and innovation through the use of AI, like what we're doing at PPRA. There's really some incredible and exciting technology happening in the field of AI and drug discovery and gene editing and protein folding and just the list goes on. So how that affects me personally, I'm very healthy at the moment. I focus a lot of time and energy on trying to maintain a healthy lifestyle. I've been doing intermittent fasting for 10 years.
Will you recommend that?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. 100%. Yeah, it's one of the best decisions I've ever made.
That's like, what, how many hours without eating?
Typically 16 or more.
16, okay.
Yeah, like you want to try to do a minimum of 16. Mm-hmm. So I basically don't eat breakfast. And most people are like, oh, but breakfast is the most important meal of the day, and I love it so much. It is not the most important meal of the day. That's nonsense. That's Kellogg's that came up with that nonsense, right?
Good marketing.
That is 100% branding, you know? That's right. That's right up there with, De Beers. Yeah. You have to a diamond, and it has to be 3 months. Well, first it was 1 month salary, and then they changed it. They changed it to it has to be 2 months salary. And, I mean... Mm. So,
or like the milk thing, like
the
milk
is
healthy.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So I mean, you know, as hunter gatherers, we ate for thousands of years. We ate when there was food available, right? And often we didn't have food, so we fasted without knowing we were like meaning to fast. But that what happens in our bodies during the fasting is super exciting as we go through the different phases of. Ketosis, we start burning fat, then we go into autophagy, we start repairing damage, and then we go into cell repair and rejuvenation, usually around 72 hours. So if you do longer fasts, which I do from time to time, you basically start resetting your clock and you start going into this rejuvenation process, creating new stem cells. And it's so it's...
What was your longest fasting period?
7 days.
7 days?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and it seems hard, but like, for example, the breakfast thing, right? So we have this, we produce this hormone called ghrelin, and that's basically our hunger hormone. It tells us usually about a half an hour before we're normally eat our normal schedule that, hey, getting hungry, time to eat. So if you stop eating breakfast, first few days, it's painful because your body is still producing ghrelin, but your body adapts. And after a few days, you stop producing as much ghrelin and it just slowly tapers off to the point that you no longer feel hungry. It's usually about 7 to 10 days and you just don't feel hungry anymore.
Oh, wow.
And it's the same thing that happens if you move to another time zone, right? So if you go to the States, for example, and you're 6 hours or 9 hours ahead or behind, you're hungry at weird times for a little while, and then your body just adapts. You start eating in a normal schedule, and you start feeling hungry at that time zone.
So the body adapts.
The body adapts. Yeah.
So you get less tired, like if you eat less. Like I heard of this.
Yeah,
effect.
You actually end up getting more energy. And what I learned is it's super interesting, and I'm sure a lot of your viewers know this, but the reason why we have so much more energy when we fast, because it doesn't make sense, right? You're like, you think I don't have any food, or I haven't had as much food, I should have less energy. But your body's number one principle is what? It's survival, right? We are built and engineered to survive. And as we go longer and longer without food, our body goes, oh, hey, you could die. Like, you need to eat. So you end up becoming like a superhuman. So you asked me about superpowers, right? Your body is like, you become like a superhuman so that you can go hunt, and you can be a super efficient hunter, and you can have super focus, right? You become really focused so that you can get food, you can eat, and you can continue to live. So
yeah, I need to try that over Christmas. It's going to be hard, the fasting, but...
Maybe not... over Christmas, because that's a really fun time to eat. Yeah, exactly. But maybe after. Yeah. Can be a New Year's resolution.
John Klepper, CEO and founder of Pipra. It was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much for being here. I wish you all the best. Of course, Merry Christmas, and also have a great 2026, and hope to see you soon.
Thank you so much, Jacob. The same to you.
Capricorn, connect, people, potential.